Alright, so welcome to this episode. Today we're going to be interviewing Steve Hartford. He is my uncle. Steve, did you want to go ahead and introduce yourself?
Yes, sure. In addition to being Matt's uncle, I'm also a product manager at a large tech company here in Silicon Valley.
Awesome. So what kind of responsibilities do you have as a product manager?
Sure. So a product manager, the definition varies at a lot of companies, but generally speaking, in the Valley, it means somebody who owns the business case for the product and helps guide its definition, implementation, and evolution. So I get to work with some of the best software engineers and user experience designers and product analysts and lawyers to all come together and make a product that hopefully people like.
Mm-hmm. So as a product manager, you're working with both the technical side of it, but then also kind of making sure that that product can actually fits in the marketplace, and you're kind of managing a lot of the different aspects of it.
Yeah, as a product manager, you manage the product, and there's a bunch of people across all kinds of disciplines that you work with to make that happen.
And would you say that this is like a little bit more entrepreneurial? That's kind of what it sounds like.
I mean, yeah, I think it depends on the company you're at. At the company I'm at, it is a little more entrepreneurial. You have a lot of leeway as a product manager to, for instance, suggest new products, new ideas, and make a case for those within the company. Other companies are very top-down management where you would be handed a project and say, do it. But at the company I'm with, there's a lot of appetite for new ideas.
That's awesome. So things have changed a lot after the pandemic, and I was kind of curious with remote work, how has like the culture at your company changed, both, you know, since the pandemic has kind of happened? Is there more remote work? Do you think that this is going to kind of continue in the future as well?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think when our offices closed during the pandemic, obviously it was difficult for everybody. But when things started to ease, I think people who had long commutes found that they liked not having a long commute and working remotely. And generally speaking, as we have offices all over the world, the people that I work with on a day-to-day basis, some of them are local here in the Valley, but a lot of them aren't. And so between those two things, a lot of questions came up around, well, when should people come into the workplace and what makes sense? From my perspective, I do work with a lot of people overseas, and to be in the office, just to be in a meeting room talking to people on a screen, well, I can do that from home. There is something to be said for being in person with people. I think there's a lot of information lost over video and audio meetings and calls. And also that hallway conversation people talk about, randomly encountering one of your coworkers and bringing up some topic and having something valuable come out of that chance encounter. That doesn't happen over video meetings. So there's also, I think, a human thing of just building social relationships, right? Being able to work with people efficiently and build up trust and understanding. That's hard to do over a video call. Personally, I still travel to these offices to get that in-person time. And then once that's established, I can go back to meetings and we can be effective.
Yeah.
It's still an evolving thing, like even at our company, trying to figure out, well, are there days of the week where we all should be in the office just so those chance encounters can happen? It's an evolving topic, but definitely a lot of people liked not having a long commute.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the flexibilities, it seems like that would be kind of the best scenario where you can have like a hybrid. Another question I kind of had is like, how does the culture, how is the culture at sort of this bigger firm that you're at right now compared to, I know you've also worked at a bunch of startups. How does the culture at like a startup differ from a big firm? And do you think that there's like what are the aspects of each of those kind of cultures, big tech, but also kind of small tech startup that you really liked or you found like kind of interesting?
Yeah, good question. I've worked at a number of large companies and small companies over my career, and each has their benefits and downsides. Generally speaking, I think at a small company, you have a lot of control over what you do, what the product actually is, and you have very little resources, especially for a startup, right? You have to be really scrappy, and you just simply don't have a lot of money or power you can bring to bear on your products. And then at a large company, it's exactly the opposite. You have tons of resources, but far less control over what the product is. So I think it depends just what you're looking for in a company. But yeah, both have their pluses and minuses.
Would you recommend for people who are kind of interested in going into big tech to do both the small like startup kind of scene and also the big tech scene? And is there an order that you think works better? Like, would those bigger tech companies like to see that you have startup experience if you want to work there, or vice versa?
Yeah, sure. So, in terms of career development, I think I've seen a lot of things work, right? I can give you my thoughts, but I think more generally, be great at what you do, whatever it is, and like what you do, like have fun doing it to whatever extent that's realistic, right? If you're great at what you do, and you like doing it, then everything else will just fall into place, right? It doesn't, it would be easy to get a job at a large company, a small company. It's really about what you can bring to the company. That being said, I think startups, I think, how did Elon put it? Working at a startup is like
Staring into the
staring into an
abyss
abyss
and eating
while chewing
glass.
glass. Yeah. So I think that's probably for the founder. Or people in there from day one. But yeah, I'd say a startup tends to devour time. And so if you're in a place in your life where that's okay, then great. But if, like myself, you have a family, then a more established company, a profitable company, can be a better fit for your lifestyle.
Yeah, it's cool. I think it's cool that you have like more of an, I feel like product management just sounds like more entrepreneurial. And I think it's kind of interesting that you had like that you liked working for small companies in the past, but even like at the company you're at right now, you kind of have a role that would be more on like the smaller side. I'm kind of curious, do you think that like big tech companies, big firms in general, I know there's this push for them to stay competitive with smaller firms, and there is like some sense that smaller firms have like distinct advantages over larger firms, in the sense of that creativity, you're juggling multiple roles, you're wearing multiple hats. Naturally, you see the crossover between things. Is there ways that you've seen big companies like the one you're at right now, maintain that spirit of like entrepreneurship and self-startership, self-stewardship, perhaps in your role and your like daily workings?
Yeah, I think it depends a lot on the company. I think the large tech companies are very different in their approaches. I suppose, there's no easy way for thousands of people to work together to do something. And in a large company, there is this constant push to have more people involved and to add more process and resulting in the company just moving slower. And a lot of that is understandable. A big established company has a lot to lose if it messes something up where a startup really doesn't. And so some of those things are intrinsic, but some of them, I think the company can work to find a culture and a system where it can go as fast as it can go. I've seen systems like a particular product team is given a sandbox to play in. They're given boundaries, right? As long as you don't mess up these things about our product today, right? As long as these metrics are fine, right? You don't impact whatever revenue, the number of bugs doesn't go up, you don't confuse developers or users, like some parameters, and then just let that group make their own decisions and move quickly, as long as it's in that box. That seems to be a good approach. It requires some discipline and trust, but definitely pushing that direction helps, I think, at a large company. I mean, the alternative is tons of people are involved with many decisions, and it just slows things down, as you can imagine.
Yeah. Because you also, something I was thinking about when you were explaining that is when you have a bunch of people who are making a bunch of decisions, the more input you have on a particular decision, the more you feel like you can kind of detach from that decision and you're not necessarily held responsible. You don't necessarily have like the like authority or investment in that decision or the accountability. And that might be something as well that like smaller companies have. That like big companies maybe sometimes in some cases they just steer away from that, allowing more and more people to weigh in on decisions when really sometimes the best thing to do is just to have more accountability and to say, hey, you know, you're in charge for this. And that's what you need to worry about. You don't need to worry about, you know, X, Y, and Z.
Yeah, I think that's fair. There's definitely a need for teams to feel responsibility at a large company, right? And whatever North Star metrics or whatever goals the company has, getting all those people pushing in the same direction is important. And I do think maintaining a sense of ownership does provide motivation, right? If you feel like every decision is going to be changed by all these people across the organization, it's pretty disheartening. But yeah, feedback is great, but decision making needs to be simple, and accountability actually helps.
Yeah. So what do you think the biggest lessons that you've learned in your career are? Both for like maybe people in smaller firms, bigger firms?
How much time do you have? So, the most important lessons. I guess first, going back to what I said earlier, know thyself, right? Know what you can do independent of any company you're working for. I mean, observe evidence of that, right? I did this project. I wrote this app. I did whatever. And really believe in yourself and know what you're bringing to a company. As I said earlier, in terms of career development, I think it just helps you focus on the right thing, which is the value you bring to the company, as opposed to, say, relationships you might have or some degree that you got or didn't get. At the end of the day, the company is hiring you to do something, and if you're great at it, then you don't really have to worry that much about everything else. Of course, there are various factors influencing how easy it is to find a job, right? So the economic condition, macroeconomic conditions. So right now, tech companies are not hiring as many people or any people as they did, say, a couple of years ago during the pandemic.
Yeah.
So definitely knowing yourself and bringing that with you to the company, I think, is important. I think another thing is assume good intent on the part of your coworkers. It's difficult to work with a lot of people, and obviously trust is something that can be built over time. But I think starting from square one, assuming that the person you're working with has good intent and trying to understand their point of view, and make sure that they feel like they've been heard. I think that goes a long way towards being productive in a team. What else? I don't know if this applies to everybody, but a friend of mine gave me the advice a while ago, and I've used it, which is if you do have other responsibilities outside of work, I mentioned my family, for instance, set hard boundaries, in particular for time, right? I think there's a desire to spend a lot of time doing your job. Most of these jobs are intellectual pursuits, and there's no, it's not like at the end of the day, okay, I'm done with everything that could be done. Like, it just never happens. And understandably, people want to do a great job, and that takes time. But I think it's important personally to make a decision, like, how much time do I want to spend at this job? And how much time am I going to reserve for things outside? And then just set a hard boundary. For a friend of mine was a lawyer and a big legal firm. When it was 5 o'clock, he would just stand up at his desk and say, "Okay, I'll see you guys later." And everybody was like, "What are you doing?" Right? But he just set those boundaries and kept them consistent. And at least for him, it worked well. For the time he was there, he was bringing value to the organization, and the fact that he was setting boundaries was just part of the deal of having him as an employee. So, yeah, time is the most valuable thing we have, and so deciding consciously on what sort of boundaries you want to put on your work, I think is it's been important for me. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really good advice. Yeah, I feel like one of the things that actually drew me to like trying to start this podcast and everything as well is that like I've realized that if you can find a more intelligent way to do something, it saves you just a bunch of like effort and just work. You just don't have to work as hard,
Right.
and it just saves you like a bunch of like pain and like failure. And so like in school, you're sort of taught like you get an academic understanding of a variety of subjects. And for example, if I was going to go and try to like discover math, like if I needed to use calculus for something, there's no way that I would be able to make enough mistakes. I'm not smart enough, driven enough in order to arrive at calculus to the point to where I could use it for something. But it is cool to learn calculus, the theory of calculus, so that I can then just go ahead and apply that tool to whatever I'm working on.
Yeah.
For optimization, for example. And I feel like it's also cool to get advice on like life and career and things, because this can also, in that same way, can save you a bunch of time, and that way you don't have to like start from square one, and like you only have so many like failures, so to speak, or so much time to like fail before you just need to like get things correct.
Yeah.
And so yeah, I mean, I think that stuff will be like helpful to me and just like other people listening.
Yeah,
That was kind of my motivation for that.
no, that sounds great, and I think that there's a couple of good points there. One is that a lot of people have done a lot of stuff before us, and benefiting from what they've done, the knowledge, the tools that they apply to problems, is far quicker than trying to figure everything out by yourself. I mean, realistically, in tech, for instance, there's no way you have enough time to know everything there is to know in about hardware, software, or anything else. So, and then the other thing that occurred to me was using the best tool for the job, using basically the cliche "work smarter, not harder," right? Instead of trying to work more hours to get something done, taking a step back and going, "Is there a better way that I can be doing this?" Yeah, that's incredibly valuable. It's too easy to get caught up in execution.
And so for this next part, I have to ask about artificial intelligence. So we had an
I'm not AI, in case you're wondering. Of course,
okay.
you don't have any way of proving that, I suppose, but.
Okay. So artificial intelligence has been it's been all the talk. You know, it's been very like, it's almost a hype cycle. It reminds me a lot, honestly, of like crypto, and that whole like hype cycle. So obviously ChatGPT is just incredible. ChatGPT-4 is super, super useful. It's not perfect, but it's like in several orders of magnitude. I don't know how you'd quantify it, but it seems like it's at least an order of magnitude, maybe several better than, you know, what we've seen in the past. Did you want to go over, maybe you could go over like some of the big improvements that we've had, like LLMs, and then I'm also curious how that's influenced your work on a daily basis.
Sure. Yeah, artificial intelligence. So over the last year or so, it's had a lot more, as you say, hype or noise or things going on than it did the previous N years. And I think that the primary reason is that a new approach to artificial intelligence, generative AI, became real a lot faster than I think anybody was anticipating, right? The idea, so generative AI versus classical AI. Classical AI basically says, you try to make the computer function often like a human brain, but you basically figure everything out, what you want it to do, and then you write software that does that, right? You explicitly create an ML model, a machine learning model, where you understand sort of what you want to accomplish, and you build it and say go and see what happens. And some of that is coming up with these sort of black boxes where you're feeding inputs into the system and it's optimizing, but you're not explicitly telling it how to optimize. So that's all classical AI. And the thing that happened quickly recently was generative AI, where you're not explicitly programming what you want to happen. You're not saying, based on how frequently the person uses something, suggest something else, right? You're not explicitly going in with that. Instead, you're taking often a large amount of information that's been generated before, and you're simply building a system that uses that to try to predict and create something valuable, right? So large language models. So GPT-4, this is where you take essentially everything people have ever written and feed it into this model. Past couple of years, this was doing useful things like suggesting the next word to type, right? So you'd go into Gmail and start typing something to somebody, and it would suggest like the next word or the next couple words. And a lot of times it was right, and it just saved time. So that's an example of language. And then what happened was, as those systems scaled, so people just made them larger with more layers of prediction, essentially, as they scaled, there was this emergent behavior where when you were doing something like just hooking up a chat engine, say, it was able to quote unquote predict or generate responses that were far more nuanced and far more useful than anyone thought they would be, at least anytime soon, right? It's a large leap from saying, I'll talk to you, and then the next word is later. It's a large step to go from that to, how can I manage my my complex desire for poetry and the limited time I like these saying something useful and responding to a query like that was surprising, right? And so I think that's the thing that shook everybody up. Both the large language models are the most visible part of that, but then there's also the imagery side, right? Where you can ask this AI to complete a painting or to paint something entirely from scratch. And we're seeing that with images, and then soon we'll be seeing that with video as well. So the whole field of generative AI is all the new excitement.
Yeah, it's really cool. I remember playing with it for the first time, just kind of asking it to first I played with just kind of having it write for me and then kind of explaining some things, which was all really impressive. I kind of had to replaced like from like search for me. So usually now I'll just go into ChatGPT and say, how do I do whatever? And ChatGPT will
Yeah.
explain.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, even if after you understand how these things work, it's still, at least for me, it's still jarring. It's still, there's some magical element to it that I think is the reason for all the excitement. Now, is this hype or not? I think nobody knows, right? Certainly, we've seen GPT and large language models like it evolve, right? Even over the last year. But there's a lot, it seems like there's a large distance between that and general intelligence, right? AGI, artificial general intelligence, where the AI can do everything a human can do in terms of reasoning and functioning in the world, planning, etc. It seems like there's a large distance from here to there. It seems like these large language models do what they do, and we're making them better at that particular approach. But like the problem of these models being very certain about their response when their response is completely wrong, right? That's a major problem that doesn't seem to have any magic bullet for it, at least not yet. So I think the excitement around what they can do today is appropriate, but the hype about how far a general intelligence is, from where I sit, that's not next year, but who knows?
I know it's like impossible to kind of put a time frame down for when we would hit AGI, but like when do you think we could potentially start to hit that? And or like what are a few of the key like milestones that would indicate that wow, we're kind of really getting close to this?
Right. Yeah, there's actually a lecture given by a Microsoft scientist who was involved with their integration of GPT, where he outlines nine or so attributes of intelligence and walks through, okay, well, what has GPT met and what has it not done, right? And out of that lecture, I don't recall specifically, but it was like five out of the nine it actually does now, and the other four are what's left. So that seems to me a good yardstick as any to try to say, okay, well, when is this general intelligence? I think the thing that people don't appreciate about general intelligence is once you have an artificial intelligence that can do all of those things and can improve itself, then it's instantly smarter than the smartest human that ever lived, right? And so one sign that we're there is it'll instantly be smarter than us. Any problem you could throw at it, anything you'd want to do. I don't think it's crazy to say something like you would, maybe it's a simplification, but you would type in cure cancer and it would go, okay, here's the pill that you can make, right? Maybe that's a little further off, but this idea that we're looking for a human level intelligence, I think human level intelligence is just a random artifact of evolution, right? There's nothing magic about how smart humans are. So So yeah, definitely once it can teach itself and do all these things, it's gone.
Yeah, it's the first thing I thought of when I started playing around with the like having ChatGPT like write programs for me was just like the recursive element that you were talking about, where it's like, wow, you know, this thing can just change its own code and just iterate and recursively improve itself, and you know, in a matter of maybe days or less, it could.
Yeah, it's interesting because the chat systems, they can preserve the session, right? You have a back and forth discussion with it, and like you say, it can do something and you can kind of guide it to change, to get closer to what you want it to do. And that's all in the context of, a session, a conversation, if you will. But what these systems aren't doing today is using any of that information to improve the model itself, right? It's the way these models are created, to simplify, is you have the computer read a ton of stuff and encode it in a specific way. And then you do, basically, you use it, you put it in front of a bunch of people to have them tweak it, right? Is the model generating logical responses? And is the model, how do we prevent the model from doing things that are not good or legal, right? So it reads all the stuff, people at the company manually massage it, and then it's used. But once, when individual users are interacting with it, it's not improving itself. It's just maintaining the conversation that you're currently in. So yeah, I think that's a big distinction. Being able to actually learn something new and then use it is a characteristic of intelligence that these things don't have right now.
Yeah. And that could be, do you think this could be turned on, so to speak, or it could be incorporated into like the next GPT model, like GPT-5, for example?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't honestly know enough about the LLMs to be able to say how difficult or easy that is to do. I think there's the difficulty of it, and then there's also, is this a good idea, right? And I don't know if you wanted to get into the security of it all.
Yeah, that's something I'm pretty interested
Yeah,
in.
so there's two different reasons for concern. And I would say that these are distinct from, say, crypto or streaming music or other sort of industry-changing innovations that came before it. AI is, I think, has the potential to pose really serious dangers if we don't do this right. So today's systems, I don't think, are anything exponentially riskier, right? So you can use, say, the large language model to make nefarious things work better, right? So you go on social networks and you want to hack an election by adjusting everybody's opinion, manipulating it. So, this is already done apparently by foreign governments and setting up, fake accounts on all these social networks and feeding specific information into it, etc. Okay, but what if you had the large language model understand all that? It would give theoretically far more compelling reasons for people to believe things, even if they're not true. Right? A much more nuanced way to understand language and to convey a point, right? So that's an example of something that where this these large language models could be abused today. That's distinct from some future AI, right? And lots of people have written about this before, but the idea that once an intelligence is orders of magnitude smarter than we are, how do we know that it will behave in a way that's aligned with our interests, right? And one of the examples always given is how we relate to ants, right? Most people, it's not like they go out of their way to kill ants, but if they're on their property, or like, you don't give it a second thought, right? You just step on them. And so who knows what a advanced AI might be doing, and how do we make sure it's aligned with our interests? I think that's a very active area of research and something that we haven't figured out yet. So it's a bit of a race. Can we figure that out before general intelligence arrives or not?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Something I was thinking about is the idea of like physical aggression in that, or strength. And something that came to my mind is some sharks are huge and they have like a great degree of physical strength and physical superiority over me, say. Even if I'm more intelligent than, say, a great white shark, I'm still like scared when I see one. So is there, I don't know exactly what the propositions are for to solve the alignment problem, but could one of those possible solutions be, is there any way that we could have physical strength which could supplement our lack of intellectual superiority over this sort of like this sort of like intelligence that is in some way like a child of us? Like,
yeah, it's a good question. Another version of like, can we solve the problem in the physical world is, well, can't you just unplug the thing? Right. So, yeah, I don't know. There's lots of things people have proposed and are actively researching, right, ways to approach this. I think the strength thing is actually something Elon mentioned about the Tesla bot, right, that it's only going to move so quickly, and so therefore you can always run away from it, right? Yeah, I mean, I guess from a physical standpoint, but then, you know, I see Boston Dynamics and clearly that's not what they're doing. Yeah, you can imagine Boston Dynamics robots paired with some kind of evil genius general intelligence would be quite a problem.
Yeah, Spot's gonna chase me down. So other than artificial intelligence, which is like, you know, it's kind of has mainstream media attention right now, as well as, I mean, a lot of non-mainstream, like people on Twitter that I follow, all they're talking about, a lot of YouTube, how you can make $1 million a day, you know, with artificial intelligence. What other interesting trends do you see that are going to kind of come into, that are either emerge out of big tech or going to heavily influence big tech in just society as general in the next like 5, 6, 7 years?
You mean technical evolutions? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. AI is grabbing so much of the attention right now. But I mean, you know, AI isn't a thing, it's a platform. So AI will change almost everything that we do, regardless of, say, what job domain or human endeavor. Like, even with the technology we have now, all the things are gonna change. So I think it's appropriate that it grabs so much of the limelight. I mean, obviously there's other powerful new innovations. You know far more about crypto than I do, for instance. In terms of things, other things that are more disruptive, I think a lot of what we do today in tech is very, it's very iterative, right? It's incremental progress, and it's valuable, right? If there's 1 billion people using a product and you make it 30 seconds faster to do a task, okay, well, 30 seconds times 1 billion people, you've saved a lot of valuable time. But it's not, you know, it's not AI, it's not crypto. So, yeah.
30 billion seconds. That has to be a lot of human lives.
Yeah, right. It's working at one of these large tech companies is an opportunity to touch a lot of people and try to do something useful. So.
So, speaking of touching a lot of people, what would you say that you value the most?
Just period in life, what do I value the most?
Like, what are the words that you'd use to like describe your
My
values? Is
value.
it like, do you value freedom or like beauty
Okay,
or
philosophy.
truth?
Let me change hats. I think starting with people, right? I value myself and other people, right? I value consciousness. I value people. And then that's kind of the starting point. And from there, then things that, as Sam Harris says, things that enhance human flourishing, right? How do we work with other people so that a lot of people have better and better lives, right? So I think naturally coming out of that are things like trust, right? We have to trust each other to do something useful together. Love, right? Love is partially biologically and evolution wired, but it's also can be intellectual and conscious. So I think, caring and caring deeply for other people is something valuable that falls out of that. Truth is important, right? If we're gonna do useful things with other people, they need to trust that what we're saying is accurate. Yeah, I'm afraid I'm not going to be having any breakthroughs in my thoughts on values, but I guess that's a good start personally.
Cool. I mean, one thing I'm always interested in when I meet someone for, like, for the first time, and obviously we've talked before, I kind of know what it is that you value already, but it is really interesting to see how people's lives differ based on the things that they value. So thanks for answering that. I have another question kind of related to the idea of human flourishing. As our world becomes increasingly, or as our lives become increasingly digital, how do we maintain a sense of like, how do we maintain the human experience and maintain like sort of what it means to be a human in this new technological world? Because obviously it's changing a lot of the ways that we have thought about ourselves in the past, and it's kind of forcing us to think about ourselves in new ways. And obviously, we try some of these new ways out. Some of them maybe are better than others. But how do we, is there a sort of a framework or an idea or some sort of theme or heuristic that we can apply to finding good ways to live in a world that we've never lived in before?
Yeah, well, you're heading me on the deep questions. I'm obviously not an expert in philosophy or anything, but I'll give you my thoughts. I think there's two concepts in there. One of them is how do we keep ourselves human? How do we maintain a human experience? And then the other one is what can we do, and how do we think about what we can do? So, I guess first you'd have to define what you mean by a human experience. Like, what part of our everyday experience is somehow valuable, uniquely, some unique characteristics of being human that we'd want to maintain? As more of our lives become digital, I think Mark Zuckerberg would tell you it's the metaverse, right? It's having the sensory enough sensory experience, enough IO that the social interaction that you have with other people, and even the interaction you have with tangible things, is replicated enough that you have the same experience you would have in reality. But then, is that what you mean when you say you want to preserve human experience? Is that what you mean?
I don't know. I would say, like, as I go through my day, there's certain parts that feel, that make me feel more like a human than other parts. Certainly when I'm replying to emails, I feel sort of like it, maybe it's a spectrum. I feel a little bit less like a human when I'm replying to, you know, 5, 6, 7 emails. But then I feel maybe a little bit more human when I, you know, do something IRL, you know, hang out with people or meet with someone or have a conversation or a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
And so, like, yeah, the whole spectrum, like, I don't know if you have thoughts on that.
I think we're social creatures, and the interaction with others and having these shared experiences is, it's something that is important for us, right? It takes a village, as they say, people together. And so I think in person, that complete interaction, right? All of the different aspects of speech and movement and chemicals in the air, like whatever it is, there's this fully rich experience of interacting with somebody in person. And, you know, you can imagine even a metaverse of 5 years from now is probably only going to do part of that. It may start to be convincing in ways that it isn't today, but yeah, the experience, the full experience of being with other people is definitely fulfilling for myself as well.
Awesome. Well, I know that you do have to run soon, but thank you for your time, your insight. It's a pleasure talking with you. Was there anything else that you wanted to close
Yeah,
on?
No, thanks. It was nice to talk to you too, nephew. I mean, I think this is great. I love the platform of podcasts for having in-depth discussions with people and sharing those with the world. So yeah, I'd encourage you to continue.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, I hope you have a nice
yeah, thanks. You
and
too.
Productive rest of your day.
Cheers.